willingness to believe them. One of the achievements of Stalinism was, in effect, that in spite of the fact that plenty of information was available contradicting the official picture, it was possible to impose the latter upon journalists, sociologists, and other visitors by methods which, on the face of it, seemed crude and obvious, but which worked splendidly. Tourists visited Russia on a bigger scale in the Azov period than ever before. They saw nothing. The nighttime arrests, the torture chambers of the Lefortovo and the crowded cells of the Butyrka, the millions of prisoners cold and hungry in the great camps of the north were all hidden from them. The only dramatic scenes were the three great public trials. And these, too, were strictly controlled and did not depart much from a prepared script. For if access to Russia was extensive, it was also imperfect. The Soviet government at this time maintained its model prison at Bolshevo, which many foreign visitors were shown. The Webs give it a laudatory account, and it had also attracted favorable comment from D.N. Pritt, Harold Lasky, and many others. One friendly visitor had the opportunity of gaining a rather broader view, Jerzy Glucksman, who, as a progressive member of the Warsaw City Council before the war, visited and reported enthusiastically on Bolshevo and the new humanitarian methods of criminology. A few years later, he found himself in camps more representative of Soviet penal practice. Other prisoners report occasionally passing through the model blocks, known to prisoners as and tourist prisons, which were shown to foreign sociologists and journalists. Herling Komatilda, while in an ordinary cell in the Leningrad transit prison, which he describes as better than usual, with only 70 prisoners in a cell intended for 20, was taken by chance through a model wing, evidently that described by Lenka von Korber in her enthusiastic book about the Soviet prison system, Soviet Russia Fights Crime. On the other end of the judicial process, the trials themselves, we have already quoted one or two Western reports. Of others, that of the eminent British pro-communist lawyer Pritt, who attended the Zinoviev trial, is especially interesting, since in his autobiography published in 1966, long after the Khrushchev revelations, he wrote that he still had a socialist belief that a socialist state would not try people unless there was a strong case against them. He added, "What the Soviet views are now, I don't know." Equals. Every journalist Pritt spoke to thought the trial fair, and, he remarks, certainly every foreign observer thought the same. This is not so, of course, but the fact that even considerable partisanship could suggest it is presumably a sign that far too many did think so. One can certainly detect in some of the journalists, in particular, a certain professional vanity, that they could be duped was inconceivable. Then, once committed, a sort of blindness came over them. Walter Durandy of the New York Times spoke Russian, had been in Russia for years, and knew some of the accused. For years, he had built a disgraceful career on consciously misleading an important section of American opinion. He now described Ulrich as a hard judge but a just one, said, "No one who heard Pyatakov or Muralov could doubt for a moment that what they said was true," and concluded, "The future historian will probably accept the Stalinist version." He argued that Muralov and Pyatakov were so impervious to pressure that their confessions could not have been false, and found one of the strongest proofs of Pyatakov's guilt to be the fact that he was the brains of heavy industry and therefore Stalin would not have killed him unless his crimes were beyond pardon. As we have seen, this sort of common sense did not, in fact, apply. Durandy's argument about Gamernik's suicide is another example of the muddled advocacy thought acceptable in the period. His suicide proves that he had been engaged in some deal with the Germans. Of the other military conspirators, Durandy argued that they confessed without long preparation, and this was an indication of the truth of the charges, while it also showed that confession was not necessarily the product of long interrogation. But of course the evidence that the generals had confessed was simply that Stalin's press said they had done so. The trial was not public. Professor Owen Lattimore was another noted apologist for the Stalin and similar regimes. In his Pacific Affairs, he wrote of Yazhov, "As to the suggestion that the new head of the Secret Service is likely to abuse his power just as Yagoda did, it is obvious that the publicity given in the Soviet Union itself to Yagoda's turpitude is a safeguard against any such thing," and he described the trials themselves as a triumph for democracy on the grounds that they could only give the ordinary citizen more courage to protest, loudly, whenever he finds himself being victimized by someone in the party or someone in the government. That sounds to me like democracy. Equals. Not only leftists and journalists wrote this sort of thing. The American ambassador Joseph Davis reported to the Secretary of State that there was proof, beyond reasonable doubt, to justify the verdict of guilty of treason. Equals. During wartime lectures, Davis used to get a laugh, which he greatly appreciated, to his answer to questions about fifth columnists in Russia. "There aren't any, they shot them all." Both parts of this piece of gallows wit are untrue. The men shot were not fifth columnists. And fifth columnists rose by the thousand, even in spite of the repulsive policies of the Germans. Most of them were, moreover, people who would never, under a moderately popular regime, have thought of going over to the enemy. Stalin's policies created a vast pool of potential treason which, had the Nazis not been foolish as well as foul, might well have decided the war. This sort of reporting is more or less ephemeral. We should perhaps take more serious and studious treatments as still more reprehensible. Scholars and Russian experts were duped to the same degree as journalists and lawyers. When Beatrice and Sidney Webb examined Soviet matters, and put their conclusions into their vast tome Soviet Communism, A New Civilization, the Constitution much impressed them. So did the constitutions and the statutes of the party, the trade unions, the consumer cooperatives, the collective farms. And, indeed, if these documents had ever been put into operation, they might have produced the society the Webbs thought they saw. It doubtless never occurred to the Webbs, brought up in Britain, that official documents do not necessarily bear much relation to fact. As it is, their book is to be regarded less as an account of a real country than as a successor to the works of Sir Thomas More, Campanella, Plato, Harrington, and William Morris. It was unfortunate, and this, of course, applied not only to the Webbs, that the perfectly natural human activity of constructing utopias should, through various misunderstandings, have been projected onto aerial community with so little claim to it. The Webbs assert flatly that Kirov's assassin was discovered to have secret connections with conspiratorial circles of ever-widening range. On the executions immediately following the assassination, they say that those shot did not seem to have been proven accomplices in the assassination or the conspiracies associated therewith, but that they were undoubtedly guilty of illegal entry and inexcusably bearing arms and bombs. Equals undoubtedly seems a strong word, when the sole evidence was a brief announcement to that effect in the Soviet press. They describe the Moscow trials as a tragic hangover from the violence of the revolution and the civil war. Of course, there is a sense in which all these events are connected, but the image does not seem appropriate as it stands. A hangover which suddenly reaches its climax 16 years after the events supposed to have caused it requires some special explanation. The Webb's comment, truly though not perhaps in the sense in which they meant it, that the trials produced some international revulsion against the Soviet Union and that therefore the Soviet government must have had strong grounds for the action which has involved such unwelcome consequences. Claiming to attempt a detached and philosophic interpretation of the trials, they say that the whole manner of the confessions was convincing, and that careful perusal of the full reports of the proceedings left them with the same impression, though they express a reservation about Trotsky. They explain the confessions as due to Russian prisoners behaving naturally and sensibly, as Englishmen would were they not virtually compelled by their highly artificial legal system to go through a routine which is useful to the accused only when there is some doubt as to the facts or as to the guilt or innocence of the conduct in question. This curious view of the comparability of the Soviet and British legal systems was shared by Professor Harold Lossky, who noted that basically I did not observe much difference between the general character of a trial in Russia and in this country. In Vyshinsky, with whom he had a long discussion, he found a man whose passion was law reform. He was doing what an ideal minister of justice would do if we had such a person in Great Britain, forcing his colleagues to consider what is meant by actual experience of the law in action. This was indeed published before Vyshinsky's great days. But trials had already taken place in Russia, and with Vyshinsky's active participation, which might have produced qualms. Another serious student of Russia, and of agriculture in particular, was Sir John Maynard, from whom it had been possible to hide the Ukrainian famine. On the trials, he remarked, however much falsity of detail there may be, the trials of the leading personages in 1936-38 were substantially justified by facts, and were probably the means of saving the USSR from an attempted revolution which would have given to the Nazi government an earlier opportunity. Sir Bernard Pears, a serious historian and long-established expert on all things Russian, was equally duped. The later editions of Pears's History of Russia cover the period to the end of the Second World War. Dealing with the purges, he permits himself to say, nearly all admitted having conspired against the life of Stalin and others, and on this point it is not necessary to doubt them. Roddick, who spoke with consummate lucidity, gave what is probably a true picture. On the Tukhachevsky case, of which, it may be remembered, no evidence whatever was made public, he merely points out that the Russian and German general staffs had earlier been in contact, and therefore it is by no means unlikely that there was a plot. A generation earlier, the conscience of the civilized world could be aroused by the false condemnation to imprisonment of a single French captain for a crime which had actually been committed, though not by him. The Soviet equivalent of the Dreyfus case involved the execution of thousands of officers, from marshals and admirals down, on charges which were totally imaginary. It called forth instead, and not from Pears alone, comments like the above. Of the trials in general, Pears concludes, the plea that Stalin acted first to disrupt a potential fifth column is by no means unwarranted. Elsewhere he remarks that the bulky verbatim reports were in any case impressive, perhaps the most fatuous of all comments, and the fine fruit, as Walter LeCur has said, of 50 years of study of Russian history, the Russian people, its country, its language. As an old authority on Russia, Pears had been opposed to the Soviet government and revised his attitude in view of the Nazi threat. Towards the end of 1935, his son comments, "My father set foot in Russia once more and any remaining doubts vanished at once." He had not left the Moscow railway station before his mind was flooded with the realization that the Bolsheviks were, after all, Russia. This reliance on personal revelation and intuition, inadequately related to the real situation, is surely inappropriate and egocentric, a point worth making when we read similar accounts from more recently totalitarianized lands. What happened in Russia under Stalin could not be understood or estimated in any commonsensical fashion, if by common sense we mean notions that sound reasonable and natural to the democratic Westerner. Many of the misunderstandings which appeared in Britain and America during the Great Trials were due to prejudice, not necessarily to prejudice in favor of the Soviet regime or of Stalin, but at least prejudice in regard to certain events or interpretations of them as inherently unlikely. The Great Trials were, and it should have been plain at the time, nothing but large-scale frame-ups. But it was extraordinarily difficult for many in the West to credit this, to believe that a state could really perpetrate on a vast scale such a cheap and third-rate system of falsehood. Bernard Shaw typically remarked, "I find it just as hard to believe that Stalin is a vulgar gangster as that Trotsky is an assassin." Presumably, he would not have been surprised at some such events in quite highly organized societies like Imperial Rome or Renaissance Florence. But the Soviet state appeared to have a certain impersonality, and not obviously to lend itself to actions determined not so much by political ideas as by the overt personal plotting which had afflicted those earlier regimes. There was another powerful factor. Both opponents of and sympathizers with the Russian Revolution thought of the communists as a group of dedicated, or fanatical, men whose faults or virtues were at any rate incompatible with common crime, something like the Jesuits of the Counter-Reformation. England has had little recent experience of revolutionary movements, and this idea persists. It is the type of general notion which the uninformed are likely to assume simply out of ignorance, and it has not lost its obscuring power to this day. Men like Stalin, Kaganovich, Voroshilov, Molotov, and Yagoda had been members of the underground Bolshevik Party in the time of its illegal struggle against Tsardom. Whatever their faults, they had thus established at least enough bona fides to exempt them from the suspicion that they did in fact behave as they are now known to have done. Even now, doubtless, there are those in the West who find it hard to swallow the notion of the top leaders of the Soviet Communist Party writing obscene and brutal comments on the appeals for mercy of the men they knew to be totally innocent. The mistake was, in fact, in the idea held in this country about revolutionary movements. In practice, they not only are joined by Simon pure idealists, but also consist of a hodgepodge of members in whom the idealist component is accompanied by all sorts of motivations, vanity, power-seeking, and mere freakishness. Perhaps the commonest reaction was to believe that the case against the accused in the trials was exaggerated, rather than false in every respect. This formula enabled those who subscribed to it to strike what they felt to be a decent commonsensical balance. In fact, it was simply a mediocre compromise between truth and falsehood, between right and wrong. And the trials were at least directed against rivals of Stalin. The idea that Stalin had himself organized the murder of Kirov, on the face of it his closest ally and supporter, a murder in strictly criminal style, would have been rejected as absurd. When it was suggested by a few ex-oppositionists and defectors, who knew more about the circumstances than most people, it was hardly thought worth discussing. Such attitudes showed a basic misunderstanding of the range of political possibility in a non-democratic culture. More particularly, they showed a failure to grasp Soviet circumstances and, above all, a misjudgment about Stalin personally. For Stalin's political genius consisted precisely in this: he recognized no limitations, either moral or intellectual, in his methods of securing power. His calculation about the effect abroad was on the whole sound. It is true that the frame-ups were clumsy fabrications. It is also true that Stalin did not in fact silence everyone who knew anything about them. But he did not have to. The notion that things would have been very different if the frame-ups had been seamlessly perfect and if everyone who had known the truth had instantly been shot is a superficial one. Stalin had a clearer idea of the state of the public mind both in Russia and in the West. It is only too plain that he was right. Those who were prepared to believe his story believed it regardless of its peripheral faults, and rejected accounts put out by people who had access to the correct information. Thus a state prepared flatly to deny its own malpractices, and to prevent open access to the facts, could successfully persuade many people abroad, even in spite of a large and growing body of first-hand evidence from those who had actually experienced the terror. This is a lesson that has clearly been learned by similar regimes in other parts of the world, and is still the basic principle of much misinformation that appears in the West. The trials were overt acts. The other acts of the purge were never announced. In particular, the size and nature of the labor camp system only became known in the West through defectors, some of them former inmates. After the Poles in Russia were released in 1941 and 1942, thousands of accounts were available for checking, and dozens of first-hand descriptions were readily available in print. By 1948, as we have said, a very full analysis of the system listing hundreds of camps, together with reproductions of camp documents, was published by David J. Dallin and Boris I. Nikolaevsky. The United Kingdom delegation to the United Nations was able to circulate the corrective labor codex of the RSFSR. Free trade union bodies produced their own analyses. The evidence was as complete and as consistent as it could conceivably be. It was widely rejected. Jean-Paul Sartre even defended the proposition that the evidence about the Soviet forced labor camp system should be ignored, even if true, on the grounds that otherwise the French proletariat might be thrown into despair. Why the labor camp population should be sacrificed to the, rather smaller, membership of the CGT was not clear, nor, indeed, was it ever made plain why the views of the French proletariat, one of the few that has ever come largely under communist influence, should prevail in world affairs any more than those of the anti-communist British and American and German proletariats. Nor is it obvious at first sight why falsehood should demand the allegiance even of the intelligentsia. This sort of intellectual and ethical attitude might be treated as a passing aberration, a curiosity of history, and one might have thought that anyone holding it would have forfeited any public standing as a moral arbiter, at least in this sort of sphere. But this does not seem to have been the case, and if only for that reason is worth referring to. During the 1940s and 1950s, there were many attempts to silence or discredit the evidence of men who had been in the camps, or otherwise given information about the purge. This was particularly the case in France. In 1950, the writer David Rousset, of the Commission Internationale contre le Régime Concentrationnaire, sued the communist weekly Les Lettres Françaises for libel. It had alleged that he had falsified a quotation from the Soviet Penal Code. As often in French political cases, themes much broader than the point supposedly at issue were developed. And, against a venomous defense by communist lawyers, the facts of the forced labor system were publicly established. One of the witnesses was Alexander Weisberg. An Austrian, a Jew, and, up to the time of his period in a Soviet prison, a communist, he was continually subjected to abuse by the defense counsel in the style, "It turns my stomach to see a German testifying before a French court." The campaign to smear the witness did not work well in this instance, as he was able to produce an appeal which had been sent at the time of his imprisonment to the Soviet authorities testifying to his character and to his loyal service to the Soviet Union, and had been signed by a number of leading physicists, including the communist Joliot Curie. The most useful and interesting "I Chose Freedom" by Viktor Kropchenko was similarly smeared in one of the most thorough and vicious campaigns of the time. Older readers will probably recall the title with a vague feeling of unease, or hostility, induced by these methods. Trademark Kropchenko, too, became involved in a court case in France, and in this instance the Russians sent witnesses to oppose him, while the French Communist Party mobilized a powerful legal and extra-legal team. The French communist Les Lettres Françaises had published an article supposedly by an American journalist called Sim Thomas, who had allegedly claimed that a friend of his in the OSS had admitted that Kropchenko's book was faked by that organization. Thomas was never produced, and it was later revealed by the editor concerned that he never existed. The trial proved a disaster to the communists, though the French literary men concerned invariably countered facts supported by an impressive array of eyewitnesses by emotional appeals about the Battle of Stalingrad. They also put forward, to refute men who had actually been in labor camps and had otherwise suffered, witnesses such as the Dean of Canterbury and Connicile Yacous, who found themselves able to assert that full, or at least admirable, liberty prevailed in the Soviet Union. The Soviet government also sent a number of witnesses, but they proved unused to hostile cross-questioning, and were on the whole disastrous. For example, the Soviet witness Vasilenko, who had been an official in the Ukraine during the purges, answered questions about the period. Izard, What became of the following members of the Politburo who were in office before the purges in the Ukraine? Kosyer, Vasilenko, Izard, 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 Vasilenko. I don't know him. Zatonsky? I don't recall that name. They were the members of the government of the Ukraine when you were working there. Belitsky? I don't recall that name. Petrovsky? He's working in Moscow. He wasn't purged? No. Kataevich? I don't know where he is. Naturally. Leshenko? I don't recall that name. Disappeared. Suhomlin? I don't recall that name. Yakir? I don't know. It will be seen that Vasilenko, under pressure, seems to have forgotten that the deaths in disgrace of both Yakir and Leshenko had been publicly announced. He was then asked what had happened to the four secretaries of his own local provincial party, and did not know. Although himself a leading industrialist in the area, when asked about 15 of the main managers and engineers, he denied knowing anything about what had happened to 10 of them, two had died natural deaths. Unfortunately, when pressed about the missing 10, he snarled back, "Why do you make yourself the defender of people like them?" A remark not compatible with ignorance of their fate. This public illustration of the official Soviet mind at work is of interest far beyond the particular context of the trial. Kravchenko won his case, and won it flatly and clearly, as the non-communist press of the West agreed. Much credit went to his lawyer, the resistance hero and former socialist deputy Mater Izard, who had himself been a prisoner of the Gestapo. But in the main, the result depended on the chance that Kravchenko was of quick intelligence, capable of coping with skilled French lawyers. And even with his victory, as the details began to be forgotten, the mud was again picked up, was flung, and stuck. As for Paris intellectuals without any knowledge of Russia, they had a sound safety mechanism. All they had to know was that Kravchenko was opposed to the Soviet system. This proved he was wrong. 30 years later, the Les Lewis Français editor responsible, Claude Morgan, admitted in his autobiography, Don Quixote et l'Autre, that Kravchenko was right. He said that after Kravchenko's death, he had wished to pay him homage, but it was as yet too early. Even when the existence of camps was admitted, they were described as of a most humane and reformatory nature. Pat Sloan, the British communist chiefly concerned with cultural liaison with the USSR, wrote, "Compared with the significance of that term in Britain, Soviet imprisonment stands out as an almost enjoyable experience. For the essence of Soviet imprisonment is isolation from the rest of the community, together with other persons similarly isolated, with the possibility to do useful work at the place of isolation, to earn a wage for this work, and to participate in running the isolation settlement or prison in the same way as the children participate in running their school, or the workers their factory." And again, "The Soviet labor camp provides a freedom for its inmates not usual in our own prisons in this country." In 1966, he was prepared to comment on the above, "Among most writers on the USSR in the 1930s, I have least to be ashamed of, or to wish to withdraw." The editor-in-chief of Les Lewis Français, Pierre Dayx, wrote, "The camps of re-education of the Soviet Union are the achievement of the complete suppression of the exploitation of men by men, the decisive sign of the effort by victorious socialism to achieve the liberation of men from this exploitation and liberating also the oppressors, slaves of their own oppression." By a considerable irony, when One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich came out in a French edition, sponsored by the Friends of the Soviet Union, they selected Dayx to write the preface, but Dayx had, in fact, changed his views. Active falsification by partisans and, worse, theoretical justification of falsehood by philosophers were not the only causes of delusion. In addition, a general vague goodwill towards the Soviet Union, even in the 1930s, led to a tendency to palliate or ignore the facts. Dr. Margolin remarks that an entire generation of Zionists has died in Soviet prisons, camps and exile, and he comments that the Zionists of the outside world were never able to help them, not only because of the difficulties, but also because we did not care. "I do not remember seeing a single article about them in the pre-war papers. Not the least effort was made." 102. To mobilize public opinion and alleviate their fate. If this is true of the intelligent, inquisitive, and internationally minded Zionist movement, with a special interest in a special group of prisoners, it applies much more to those in the West whose interest in the matter was, or might have been, the common bonds of humanity. Whatever the Zionists felt, we should note that one great Jewish tradition remained clear and forthright in its attitude. The Old Bund, the Jewish Social Democratic Organization which had played a most important part in the Old Left, though crushed in Russia, had continued to work in the Baltic states and Poland. And in the United States, some of the most effective militants in the New York Jewish left had sprung from Bund circles. A great example is David Dubinsky, who throughout the period combined a firm radicalism with regard for the employers and an equally firm resistance to the terror in Russia, and even during the war rebuffed pressures from liberals and from the State Department, which tried to dissuade him from protest against the executions of Ehrlich and Alter. The effects of the Stalin era took a long time to sink in the West. Indeed, they were rejected by many until admitted by the dictator's diadochi. A curious resistance prevailed in which evidence which would have been thought adequate about any other regime was rejected, a phenomenon ludicrously illustrated by, again, Jean-Paul Sartre in his introduction to Henri Alleg's book about torture in Algeria. Sartre said that we now know of the existence of torture in communist countries as well, because of Khrushchev's admission and the evidence given at the trial of the Hungarian police minister Farkas. That is to say, evidence of the Alleg type, mere first-hand accounts, was to be admitted in the French, but excluded in the Russian, case. Khrushchev's revelations in February 1956 did not affect some Soviet sympathizers in the West except to the degree that they feared that the disclosures might prove disturbing to those whose faith was less firmly founded. After the publication of Khrushchev's secret speech, Professor Joliot-Curie asked Ehrenberg to be cautious when speaking about it, especially to his children. Khrushchev's revelations were disturbing to many communists. He personally knew of many errors and mistakes, even of crimes committed, registered, but he understood also that drastic changes of the whole structure of the state would cause troubles and personal hardships. These troubles could happen in any country, and they would not perturb him personally. They might, however, have a quite different effect on those who knew less. So he wished that Ehrenberg, when speaking about the Soviet Union, would choose positive rather than negative events. Such is the perhaps rational attitude of a communist. It is charitable to imagine that the great physicist had not really faced the facts of what he still thought of as unavoidable hardships. In any event, his case and the various others we have dipped into constitute a mere sketch and selection of an extraordinary potpourri of inhumanity and self-deception which a later generation might well take to heart. The Khrushchev period. When Stalin died on March 5, 1953, his successors appealed against panic and disarray. But their qualms were unnecessary. Although the single will of the creator of the new state had now gone, the machinery he had created remained in existence. And aspirations among the citizenry toward a different order of things had no possible means of expression and organization. We need not rehearse the history of the USSR over the post-Stalin period. It will be enough to note that its politics have been dominated by the problem of Stalin. Within 3 years came the major breakthrough of Khrushchev's secret speech to the 20th Party Congress, which denounced the late dictator's arbitrary rule and exposed the falsification, based on torture, of the cases against certain non-oppositionist victims such as Kosyr and Eek. The secret speech was a tremendous step forward. And it was followed, over the next 8 or 9 years, by the publication of a great deal of other material on the truths of the Stalin epoch. But passive and active opposition within the old apparatus was strong, and de-Stalinization remained incomplete and sporadic. The speech itself had been opposed by Molotov and other members of the party presidium, equivalent of the old Politburo, and it was not published in the USSR until 1989. The official line tacked and veered between dramatic though partial denunciations of the former dictator, in, for example, 1956 to 1961, and considerably more positive estimates, in, for example, 1957 and 1963. The cult of personality, a curiously inadequate description, was the invariable category in which the Stalinist past was now criticized. This was, in effect, basically an allegation of vanity and flattery, not quite the essential which had made the rule of Stalin so deplorable. It mattered much less to his victims that towns were named after him than that he was ruling by terror and falsehood. It is true that the expression implies autocracy, but it remained slightly off target. It proved compatible with allegations of extravagant tyranny, and equally with mere suggestions of the rather excessive application of necessary force depending on the vagaries of politics. Above all, it made it possible to claim that the Soviet state and the party were essentially healthy throughout the period. The successes that the working people of the Soviet Union were achieving under the leadership of the Communist Party created an atmosphere in which individual errors and shortcomings seemed less significant against the background of tremendous success. No personality cult could change the nature of the socialist state, which is based on public ownership of the means of production, the alliance of the working class and the peasantry, and the friendship of peoples. But as the Italian communist leader, Palmiro Togliatti, commented in 1956, first, all that was good was attributed to the superhuman, positive qualities of one man, Now all that is evil is attributed to his equally exceptional and even astonishing faults. In the one case, as well as in the other, we are outside the criterion of judgment intrinsic in Marxism. The true problems are evaded, which are why and how Soviet society could reach and did reach certain forms alien to the democratic way and to the legality that it had set for itself, even to the point of degeneration. Time and again, the authorities made it clear that, in the words of a 1963 Central Committee resolution, they opposed resolutely and implacably any attempt to undermine the foundations of Marxist-Leninist theory under the guise of the struggle against the personality cult, and all attempts to rehabilitate the anti-Marxist opinions and trends which were routed by the party. One of Stalin's principles, the theory that the intensity of the class conflict, and hence the necessity of terror, increases as the power of the defeated classes diminishes, was denounced, though in its official form in the party program adopted at the 22nd Congress in 1961, this denunciation was hedged with reservations. The general trend of class struggle within the socialist countries and conditions of successful socialist construction leads to the consolidation of the position of the socialist forces and weakens the resistance of the remnants of the hostile classes. But this development does not follow a straight line. Changes in the domestic or external situation may cause the class struggle to intensify in specific periods. This calls for constant vigilance. The period also saw an evolution in the forms of the enforcement of state power. The special board of the MVD was abolished in September 1953. The terror decree of December 1, 1934 was annulled on April 19, 1956. In December 1958, the new decree on state crimes replaced the relevant articles of the criminal code dating from Stalin's time. Certain notorious excesses, such as Article 58, IC, which openly inflicted penalties on the families of traitors fleeing abroad, even if they were totally unimplicated, were dropped. But the decree remained draconian and provided severe punishment for all forms of action, organization, or discussion hostile to the government. Legal practice, too, received some degree of reform. Vyshinsky was denounced, together with his theory that confessions are the main element in a good case. But confessions were still used, and treated as valid, as in the Powers and the Pankowski cases, in 1960 and 1963, respectively. The labor camp system remained in being, and no information about it was officially available. The general impression is that measures had already been taken to cut the death rate and to make forced labor economically more rational in 1950, 1951. After the death of Stalin, camp regulation seemed to have been more equitably enforced, partly as the result of mass strikes in the northern camps. The release of a large number of prisoners took place under amnesties and through rehabilitations. We are told, though this was given no publicity, that eventually about 100 commissions, one for each main camp group, were sent out. Consisting of three members, they examined all the files and rehabilitated millions, mostly posthumously. Present-day estimates are that about 8 million of the 12 million in the camps in 1952 were released. The general picture is of some camps being virtually dissolved, some losing many of their inmates, and others remaining about the same. In many areas, prisoners were released into free exile. After rebellions in the camps in 1953, Norilsk and Vorkuta, and 1954, Kinger, prisoners seem to have been transferred farther east. Reports at the end of 1956, when the operations to reduce the number of prisoners were virtually at an end, showed little change in the Kalima, Magadan complex. Repatriated prisoners of war estimated that over 1 million then still remained in the far eastern camps. Avram Dertz, Andrei Sanyavsky, remarked ironically of one camp, in The Trial Begins, that earlier the amnesty had virtually emptied the camp of its inmates. Only some 10,000 of us, dangerous criminals, were left. Discipline remained rigorous. Indeed, a decree of the Supreme Soviet of May 5, 1961 for the first time imposed the death penalty for certain acts of aggression against the administration, short of murder, in the camps. However one looks at it, the penal and police systems were reformed in the Khrushchev period. Equally, however one looks at it, they did not undergo essential change, did not become truly liberal. The regime owed its legitimacy to its descent from Stalin and was committed to the correctness of Stalin's line as against both the left and the right oppositions of the 1920s and 1930s, and hence to his correctness on basic policy matters. At the 22nd Party Congress in 1961, Khrushchev was indeed able to say publicly what had been secret in 1956, and Stalin's body was removed from Lenin's tomb, though even in 1989 it still lay on a fairly honorable position under the Kremlin wall, among the bodies of important positive figures of the second rank, and, perhaps significantly, next to that of Felix Dzerzhinsky, founder of the secret police. Many of Stalin's personal group died in good odor after their patron's own death, Shkuryatov in 1954, Vyshinsky in 1955. Men like Kaganovich and Malenkov, though publicly accused by the Prosecutor General of the USSR of criminal violations of socialist legality, also remained at liberty. The fall of Beria entailed the trials of a series of police officials of the old regime. In all, 38 security generals were deprived of their military ranks. But others survived, such as Serov, who was head of Army Intelligence until 1964. General Gorbatov, writing in the early 1960s, speaks quite naturally of his torturer, Stolbunsky. I don't know where he is now, and mentions meeting the despicable Commissar Fomich, who had organized his removal, in a group of senior officers in 1962. More basically, there was no serious attempt to deal with the terror as a whole. The great plot ostensibly headed by Trotsky, backed by the Nazis, involving politicians, generals, engineers, doctors, and ordinary citizens by the thousand, was not explicitly denounced as a fabrication. Statements were made that demolished the authenticity of some of the main public accusations. Several of those named as conspirators in the 1938 trial were rehabilitated. One major crime of the 1937 accused, the attempt on the life of Molotov, was openly described at the 22nd Party Congress in 1961 as a frame-up. On the centerpiece of the whole purge story, and the main crime of the 1936 accused in particular, the Kirov murder, we have seen that the official line was already rejected as unsatisfactory by Khrushchev in his secret speech of February 1956, and again, publicly, in his report to the 1961 Congress, each time with strong hints that Stalin had been the real organizer of the assassination. So, although the full truth was being extracted with painful slowness, enough had already been said to concede the total falsehood of the original Stalinist version. We now know that the Tukhachevsky group were legally rehabilitated by the Supreme Court on January 31, 1957, and posthumously restored to party membership on February 27, 1957. This and similar decisions were not published. It simply became plain from their reappearance in a favorable light in books and articles that they were now cleared of the charges. In this and the other cases, the published formalities were merely a note at the end of the encyclopedia entries, illegally repressed. Posthumously rehabilitated. Similarly, the executed Stalinists, Rudzutak, Chubar, Postishev, Ik, Kosyurp, and the others, were seen to be in good odor, as were such men as Yanukidze and Kara Khan. One distractive ploy by the forces of obstruction was to give to the rehabilitated death dates differing from the true ones. This was done in part, Nadezhda Mendelshtam tells us, to transfer purge victims to the war period, and thus distance them from the purges. Marshal Yegorov, Army Commander Fedko, and Vlas Chabar were among those given wartime deaths. And others were spaced out, if not so far. For example, Postishev's was for 20 years dated to 1940. No one was cleared from the Zinoviev or Pyatakov trials. And in the Bukharin trial, a fantastic situation persisted for years in which some of the accused were fully rehabilitated, and others not. Ilkhramov, Kozayev, Krestinsky, Zelensky, and Grinko were now in favor. But to rehabilitate, for example, Krestinsky without rehabilitating Rosenkoltz was to rehabilitate Burke while leaving Hare accused. Yugoslav sources said, in the autumn of 1962, that Bukharin would shortly be rehabilitated. This did not take place, though at a meeting of an all-union conference on measures to improve the training of scientific pedagogical cadres in the historical sciences, Pospilov said, students ask whether Bukharin and others were spies of foreign states. I may state that it is sufficient to study the documents of the 22nd Congress of the CPSU in order to say that neither Bukharin nor Rykov, of course, were spies or terrorists. This little publicized partial exculpation is important in principle. But Bukharin's and Rykov's names were not restored to party favor. Zinoviev, Kamenev, Pyatakov, I, and Smirnov, Sokolnikov, and Rosenkoltz, to name some of the other leading figures at the public trials, remained totally unrehabilitated. So did a good many men who had not even come to public trial, for example, Preberzhansky, Smyaga, Uglanov, and Shliapnikov. Rehabilitation, as well as being done in this illogical and partial fashion, took a variety of forms. The maximum was the full-scale article with at least a remark at the end that the man named had fallen victim to slander as a result of the personality cult. The minimum was simply the mention of the former purgee's name in a neutral or favorable context. There was, indeed, something even more minimal, if one can so express it, than the above. It was now conventional in the biographical notes on people who had played a part in the earlier history of the party and who were listed at the end of works dealing with it time to give, in addition to those of birth and death, the date of entering the party. In the case of all those in good odor, this was phrased member of the party from 1910, or whatever the date might be. In the case of those still unrehabilitated, this was invariably got into the party, Sostoil v. Partii, 1910. From this minor convention, it can be seen that, for example, Sirtsov was now, to this degree at least, restored to favor, while Preberzhansky was not. This curious, and typical, indirectness marked a failure to come to grips with the past. It is easily explicable. After Stalin's death, the machine he created continued to rule the country. The principle of one-party rule, the overriding competence of that party in all spheres of life, the preservation of its monolithic nature, and rule over it by a small central body, all continued. All the leaders had arisen in the old machine during Stalin's time. The channels through which they rose remained as then established. And the principles of rule were, in general, those then brought to fruition. The efforts of Khrushchev personally and of a number of intellectual and other figures had nevertheless made important, if partial, progress in uncovering the truth. The resistance from the whole traditionalist cadre at every level was natural. And it beat him. The Brezhnev reaction. After the fall of Khrushchev in October 1964, an end was gradually put to speculative and risky initiatives in every field. This applied also to the matter of Stalinism. The rehabilitation process virtually ceased, as did written discussions of the more sensitive areas of the Stalinist past. Stalin himself began to be treated at first with a rather cold respect and later with considerable favor, in spite of the protests of intellectuals. The system of government he created, as amended and improved under Khrushchev, was consolidated. The extent of the reaction since Khrushchev's time could be seen in the treatment of Raskolnikov. In his military memoirs, published in 1964, the introduction states flatly, "The CC of the C.PS.U. has completely rehabilitated him, and restored him posthumously to party membership and to Soviet citizenship." Even as late as 1968, his Civil War record was favorably referred to, but soon his photograph was removed from books, and various editors who had permitted favorable reference to him were reprimanded or dismissed. Finally, an article in the authoritative party organ Communist spoke of him as a deserter to the side of the enemy and a slanderer of the party in the Soviet state. Equals. This was, indeed, a special case. More generally, those rehabilitated remained so, though the expression illegally repressed. Posthumously rehabilitated disappeared from the reference books. And accounts of events of the purges simply ceased to appear. For the moment, at least, the promise of better things after 40 years in the wilderness showed little sign of fulfillment. The reason, basically, seems to be that the caravan was led by men skilled in the ways of the wilderness, and enjoying the powers they had gained and would certainly forfeit in a lusher land. For Pyatakov's miracle, the idea that by sheer political organization the party could create industry and the proletariat, which should in Marx's view have preceded the coming to power of socialism, and having done that, go back to the main line foreseen by Marx, had not worked out. The reason is plain. It had been a mistake to think that the party would, after this Marxist Dieter, simply revert to a humanist democratic representation of the new proletariat. It was not the case that Stalinist methods could be used and then simply cast aside when specific economic and social aims had been achieved. Terror institutionalizes its own cadres, its own psychology. And the party machine, whose loyalties for so long had been in practice simply to itself, whose interests for so long had been equally circumscribed, had become Geolos's new class, no more capable of easily changing its ways than the old classes and bureaucracies of the past had been. The Stalin era was a past so atrocious that its repudiation brought obvious dividends to any succeeding regime, but its successors also inherited a set of institutions and a ruling caste indoctrinated in certain habits and beliefs. And in an important sense, the essence of Stalinism is less the particular periods of terrorism or special views on industrial organization than the establishment of the political setup. And that still remained substantially unchanged. Even the Khrushchevite de-Stalinization had consisted of little more than the abandonment, or even the denunciation, of a specific set of excesses associated with the late dictator. It did not amount to any change of substance in the system of political rule in the USSR or in the basic principles behind that system. Russia was still ridden by the party machine, and the principle of Pertinost, the doctrine of the party's right to rule and to decide on all questions of speed and direction, remained untouched. What took place, in effect, was simply the renunciation of excessive use of whip and spur. There was now, in fact, a considerable effort to rehabilitate the NKVD, Criticism was leveled at those who, basing themselves on the organization's role in the purges, are not averse to putting practically all the officers of the Chica under a cloud. A whole series of novels and plays appeared, featuring secret police heroes. Those police officers condemned to imprisonment rather than death in the post-Beria purge were released, hiding on the organizer of Trotsky's assassination, among them. There were complaints that the former Georgian NKVD officer Nataraya, a specialist in shooting wives and daughters, only received 10 years after Beria's death and was now at liberty, that Colonel Monaldiev, who had shot several hundred foreign communists in the Solovetsk camps at the beginning of the Finnish War, was living in a villa near Leningrad, an attempt to have him expelled from the party having been prevented by Tolstikov, then first secretary of the Leningrad province, that the leading interrogator of the Jewish doctors in 1952, A. G. Sugak, had a job as assistant director of a museum, and a villa near Moscow, and so on. In September 1966, new articles were added to the criminal code, providing for the imprisonment of those given to uttering or writing material discrediting the Soviet state or participating in group activities involving disobedience in the face of the lawful demands of the authorities. Equals such laws led to those increasing repressions against writers and dissidents which were such a mark of the period. Further, in 1966 pressure from party traditionalists grew for a partial or indirect rehabilitation of Stalin at the 23rd Party Congress that year. It was laid down that the concept the period of the personality cult the mildest of all hostile descriptions of the Stalin period, was mistaken and un-Marxist. Strong resistance to this neo-Stalinism was aroused, being expressed in particular in a letter by the leading members of the Soviet intelligentsia, and for the moment no more was said. But in 1969, the neo-Stalinists have consolidated, and a further determined attempt was made, in connection with Stalin's 90th birthday. A statue was planned. Special lectures at the Institute of Marxism-Leninism were to take place, orders for busts and portraits were made, an edition of Stalin's works was prepared. A set-piece article in Communist wrote of Stalin's malpractices that these were mistakes in practical work which was essentially correct in fulfilling the scientifically based general line of the party. A pro-Stalin novel by Goshetov appeared in October. By the birth date in December, a long Pravda article was ready. But by now, foreign communist leaders started to put pressure on the Soviet leadership. Finally, the Politburo decided by a 120 small majority to cancel most of the celebrations. Nevertheless, the trend remained regression, not progress. It may be argued that the elan of the regime was now dead and that only momentum, habit, and institutions remained. If this view is taken, the system might appear like the legitimist monarchies of the early 19th century, impressive, powerful, but dead at heart, and remaining only as an integument which eventually broke. The argument of the communist heroine and martyr Rosa Luxemburg against the suppression of hostile opinion, and against the closed society, was not a moral one. It was simply that. Without general elections, without unrestricted freedom of press and assembly, without a free struggle of opinion, life dies out in every public institution, becomes a mere semblance of life, in which only the bureaucracy remains as the active element. Yes, we can go even further. Such conditions must cause a brutalization of public life. This was a sound prediction of developments in Russia. Until its recommendations were complied with, the Soviet Union could best be described as not fully cured, but still suffering from a milder and more chronic form of the affliction which had reached its crisis in the Azov years. The Khrushchev period, in spite of its inconsistencies, had to some extent shown a way forward. And it had made the major falsifications of the terror period untenable. In the two decades which followed Khrushchev's fall, the regime was in the intellectually scandalous position of having no official story at all, true or false, about the trials. But the 20-year period of stagnation, as it is now officially designated, saw ubiquitous falsification eating away at the intellectual, the social, the economic, and the political structure until little was left but a hollow shell. The command economy, barrack socialism, as it is now called, drove the country deeper and deeper into unacknowledged crisis. By the mid-1980s, this had become so profound that, first, all serious economic and social observers had seen the imminent danger, and second, there had been time for this knowledge to percolate to an important section of the political leadership. The decisions taken to attempt a radical reconstruction and abandonment of the false socio-economic principles which had led to this crisis involved freeing the forces of intellectual criticism, repudiating the heritage of Stalinism, and releasing the truth. Epilogue. The Terror Today. Whoever knew truth put to the worse, in a free and open encounter? Milton. As the world knows, from 1986, and much more so in the ensuing years, The USSR entered the period of Glasnost. Among the first products of Glasnost was truth about current economic and social disasters. Its sponsors made it plain, moreover, that the command economy system of Stalinism, based on endless coercion, was in itself a dead end and needed dismantling. Thus the horrors of Stalinism were at first often attacked less on humanitarian grounds than as economically counterproductive. The Soviet economist Nikolai Shmelev, in a crucial, though in theory confidential, speech in June 1987, told for the first time of 5 million peasant families having been deported, of 17 million souls having passed through the Gulag. But his theme was that this was economically worthless. What had the prisoners contributed? Three canals, one of which was useless, a reference to the Baltic White Sea Canal, and a quantity of lumber which could have been better produced by free labor. But the new Glasnost about the past was never solely economic. From the start, it became clear that Stalinism had to be tackled as a whole, if only because the Dugin Stalinist apparat could be discredited only by a full-scale and continued campaign. It was also clear that a great pressure had built up among the better elements of the intelligentsia. The lies which they had been forced to accept had already been shaken in Khrushchev's time. In the meanwhile, the sacrifices of samizdat writers, the contributions of Western scholars, the output of Western radios, had left the lies intellectually non-viable. And when the opportunity was given, a number of editors went ahead with the continued publication of facts about the terror. I ended the Great Terror with the comment that one sign of a recovery from Stalinism would be a frank confrontation with the past, so that Russians could freely and fully investigate the events of which some account has meanwhile been given in these pages. And in the Russian edition of the Great Terror, published in Florence in 1972, I deplore the fact that a history of the terror could, at that time, only be written and researched abroad. This is no longer true. Readers will have seen how often in these pages the facts are drawn from Soviet publications of the past 2 or 3 years. Not only have certain historical points been clarified and added to, but also the very nature of the terror has been confirmed. Fearful stories of labor camp life, of torture, of denunciation and falsification have appeared. And, just as important, massive confirmation of the huge impact of the terror and of the numbers of dead, deported, and imprisoned have been made public. It had been clear since the 1940s, from a variety of testimonies, that the victims numbered millions. By the late 1960s, when the Great Terror appeared, it was possible to go further. Over the years since then, additional evidence accumulated, in particular from Soviet samizdat writers like Roy Medvedev, Anton Antonov Avsenko, Peter Yakir, and others, though also from a variety of emigre and Western sources, and even from occasional Soviet material. Khrushchev himself told us in his memoirs that 10 million or more of our citizens paid with their lives in Stalin's jails and camps. In the Great Terror, I gave estimates of approximate casualty figures for 1937 to 1938. My rough totals, arrived at through the examination of a number of separate trains of evidence, were: arrests, 1937, 1938 about 7 million. Executed about 1 million. Died in camps about 2 million. In prison, late 1938 about 1 million. In camps, late 1938, assuming 5 million in camp at the about 8 end of 1936, million. I also concluded, from much Soviet and other testimony, that not more than 10% of those then in camp survived. My estimates were based on 30-odd sources, mostly unofficial, though including considerations of the 1959 census and of the secret NKVD section of the 1941 state plan. A number of further unofficial testimonies of some value have meanwhile emerged, confirming the earlier. But they, and the 15 pages of calculations and considerations in the Great Terror, had been made superfluous by Soviet figures given in 1987 to 1989. However, we may look briefly at the categories. 1. Arrests. My approximately 7 million was derived from, among several solid sources, analyses by Alexander Weisberg and other ex-prisoners of the numbers arrested in the catchment areas of various prisons, and based on prison documents warranting high confidence. Full Soviet figures have not been given. But those provided for the Kursk province? Imply a total of about 8 million for the USSR as a whole. 2. Executed, approximately 1 million. This would be the result for the USSR as a whole for those shot by troikas alone, if figures now given for Uzbekistan are taken as typical. Figures from Irkutsk imply over 1.5 million. The evidence of the Kuropaty mass graves in Minsk and the Bukovna mass graves near Kiev suggest higher figures still. My estimate was based in part on relatives' reports of the proportion of death sentences to other sentences. But while realizing that 10 years without the right of correspondence was often a euphemism for the death sentence, we did not then know that it always was. I, and Roy Medvedev, who also gives the 1 million figure, will probably turn out to have underestimated this. 3. Died in camps, 1937 and 1938, approximately 2 million. This was based on prisoners' reports of the death rate and, taken together with the execution figures, on Yugoslav sources. It would include those executed in camps, who do not figure in the execution estimate above. On the evidence of Kalama and Bamlag, this may be approximately 600,000 to 700,000. 4. In prison, late 1938, 1 million. This rough estimate was based on the known prison accommodation and many reports of the level of overcrowding, together with figures of inmates for particular prisons. These last are now confirmed in Soviet accounts. 5. In camps, late 1938, approximately 8 million. This is based in the main on multifarious reports from ex-prisoners. The assumption that 5 million were already in camps at the beginning of 1937 was derived merely from the estimates by other students of the matter, and may be too high. I should be inclined to reduce the 8 million at the end of 1938 to 7 million, or even a little less. Such a figure is consonant with the 12 million now given in Moscow for the camp population in 1952.7. The above are, in any case, only approximations. The Great Terror was only peripherally concerned with the total casualties of the Stalin epoch. But it reckoned the dead as no fewer than 20 million. This figure is now given in the USSR. And the general total of repressed is now stated, for example, in the new high school textbooks, as around 40 million, about half of them in the Peasant Terror of 1929 to 1933 and the other half from 1937 to 1953. Thus it would now be accepted almost everywhere that the estimates given above cannot be far wrong. But it is just worth recording that, though it has long been clear that the victims ran into the millions or tens of millions, Western misconceptions of the sort we discussed in Chapter 15 recently had a brief revival. Over the years, a vast amount of true information had established itself in the Western consciousness. But by an inexplicable development, when such notions no longer seemed possible, a few Western Sovietologists began to assert that the terror had claimed far fewer victims, and that ordinary life was not affected. The writer of a Western Sovietological textbook concerned to reduce the estimates to, as he put it, a few hundred thousand or even a few tens of thousands, wrote, "Surely we don't want to hypothesize 3 million executions or prison deaths in 1937 to 1938 or anything like this figure, or we're assuming most improbable percentages of men dying." The key word here is improbable. The Stalin epoch is replete with what appear as improbabilities to minds unfitted to deal with the phenomena. Similarly with the argument that Stalin could not have killed millions of peasants, since that would have been economically counterproductive. Following such leads, a new group of Westerners came forward, with singularly bad timing, in the mid-1980s and told us, in the words of one of them, that the terror had only killed thousands and imprisoned many thousands. Such views could only be formed by ignoring, or actively rejecting, the earlier evidence. This was accomplished by saying that those who produced it were opposed to Stalin and Stalinism, and therefore prejudiced, and that some of the material was second-hand. Thus it was not merely a matter of mistaken assessment of the evidence. It was, contrary to the duties of a historian, a refusal to face it. There were even demographers who, among other errors, accepted the fake census of 1939. A Soviet demographer, deploring this, explains that that census was unacceptable on three grounds. First, as I had already registered in Chapter 16 of The Harvest of Sorrow, the earlier 1937 census had been suppressed and the census board shot at spies who had exerted themselves to diminish the population, thus providing a certain incentive to their successors to find higher figures than were justified. Second, the 1939 totals were announced by Stalin before the new census board had examined the material. Third, censuses of the period omitted the deaths of those who had died in custody. It is unfortunate that implausibly benign assessments should have appeared in one or two Western textbooks and periodicals and that students should thus have been methodically misinformed. Soviet professionals with whom I have discussed this are, naturally, especially outraged. And, indeed, it is worth noting of Glasnost that it has produced a number of articles attacking Western apologists for the regime, from the webs on. Anything like complete accuracy on the casualty figures is probably unattainable. As a Soviet analysis puts it, some records were lost, or never existed. In addition, when it comes to the terror famine of 1932-1933, it will be almost impossible to sort out the infant deaths from those unborn owing to the decline in birth rate, Since registration of births and deaths ceased in the affected areas over the critical period, moreover, under the then procedures, infants dying within a few days of birth were counted as unborn. Nevertheless, it now seems that further examination of the data will not go far from the estimates we now have except, perhaps, to show them to